ugly motherfucker. Welcome to episode 51 of the Surreal Grotesque podcast. And joining me a little bit later, G. Arthur Brown, author of Kitten, a little later. And before we get to that, did you know there are over a trillion different kinds of bacteria living in our digestive systems? Now, generally, they're there to perform, you know, to keep things moving. But when our bad habits triple the growth of these germ factories, bad habits such as excessive sugar consumption, it can lead to disaster later in life. Recently, this study came out, I think it was called The American Parasite, talking about candida overgrowth in our digestive tracts. And they illustrated this bacteria, the candida. It looks like Pac-Men with snake bodies. And they live in our digestive systems either way. But what's interesting is that the more refined sugar you put in your body, the more they breed, the bigger they get. And so this can lead to candida overgrowth. And it's a fascinating video. I recommend anyone check it out if you have time to online. It's called The American Parasite. It shouldn't be too hard. And it's put out by some supplement company called Keybiotics. You know, no hidden agenda there. But candida overgrowth, you know, it's such a disturbing thing. You know, why should that one be any more dangerous than any of the other trillions that frequent our bodies, you know? And it seems like the more sugar we intake, you know, the more we run the risk of infections. Candida is basically just yeast. But just supposedly they hijack our brains to such a degree that we crave sugar because they crave sugar. It's almost like a symbiotic relationship. So yeah, that's a little disturbing. But I don't know. It isn't really possible that the candida is hijacking our systems, is it? Couldn't it just be that we have something in common with them? Maybe we're all craving sugar. Maybe us and the candida that live and fester in our bodies crave sugar. Maybe we both do, you know? It's almost like a date or something. I don't know. I'll tell you what, though. No microscopic organisms are going to get the best of me, even though I could really go for some red velvet cupcakes right now, French fries just smothered in salt, maybe jelly-filled donuts, you know. But no, I got to get it under control. I got to get it under control, man, because I've got a show to do. No candida is going to get the best of me. But sugar, man, you know, just like that old commercial, you know, just pour it down in a cup by itself. Just sugar, just raw sugar. Feed the candida. And on another note, I heard recently that my good friend and sometimes editor Garrett Cook was under attack by some people, not within Bizarro, more on the fringes, but I don't really pay attention to the negative press that Bizarro might get, you know, because I'm such a champion of Bizarro, such a fan of it, such a passionate fan of it. So I don't generally give that a lot of credence. I don't even really take bad reviews of Bizarro seriously. But I heard that Garrett Cook had come under fire recently for what I do not know. But let me just throw this out there that whatever some people may have against the man, he helped me get my first paying gig with Bizarro Cast. And it wasn't an exorbitant fee that I was given. But it was, you know, $5 that I didn't have before. And Chris Boyle of Bizarro Cast paid it to me. And Garrett Cook, you know, helped me write my first Bizarro story for Bizarro Cast. And that was Becoming Bizarro, which was appropriate, I thought. Anyone who does have any doubts about Garrett Cook's editing abilities or professionalism, I would say ask the clients that he's taken on in the last year or so. You know, go around in the circles he travels in and, you know, ask. Christoph Paul, he helped with Christoph Paul's Demons in the TV. He helped with Pat Douglas's Cucumber Punk. That's a major release from Bizarro Pulp Press, one of my favorites from last year. He helped with Don Noble's Grown Ups Must Die. And those three gentlemen are happy with Garrett's services, and like them, so am I. Many others, Chris Kelso with Moose Jaw Frontier and Transmatic, his new release, by the way. It's out now. It's a scathing indictment of Scientology with a fictional veil over it. Also, the female author's name escapes me at the moment, but she wrote a companion piece to The Frog Prince, updated for modern times, I think, and it's called Gilding the Lily Pad. And if all that isn't enough circumstantial evidence that Garrett Cook's editing services are worthy to consider paying for, then ask Barbie Wilde, the female Cenobite from Hellbound Hellraiser 2. Because I believe she's taken him on recently as an editor as well for her novel The Venus Complex. Or if not, then it may have been for her short piece in the forthcoming Imperial Youth Review, issue 3. It was one or the other. In any case, without further ado, G. Arthur Brown blazed a trail all his own with his debut for last year's New Bizarro Authors series with a Swiftian novella about dead and misplaced children, a revolving door of identities mixed and matched with an alien reasoning, and about choosing your own ending. That novella, entitled Kitten, is available right now on Amazon. Gary, how you doing today, friend?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me.
So, you made it to your second year, am I correct?
Last I checked, yeah, I'm still alive, so, yeah.
Awesome. I mean, in your dealings with Eraserhead, obviously.
second year, I suppose.
Awesome. Now, what's interesting about your novella from last year's New Bizarro Author Series, Kitten, is that it was the only novella that Kevin Donahue accepted from last year's submissions.
That's true, yes. That was definitely a big honor when I found out that I was the only one that he had accepted last year. Not to say there's no honor in the ones that Kevin Shamo accepted, but just that I was his sole choice that year, so he had a lot of chance to show attention to my project in particular, and it was really great working with him.
And I will say that you have a very unorthodox approach to writing Bizarro. There's a sort of a refusal to be categorized on display in Kitten. Were you always writing Bizarro before there was a name for it?
I didn't really know about Bizarro. Even when I first started writing Kitten, I was kind of had just begun to discover the Bizarro scene. And I'd only read a few authors at that point. Like, I'd read a little bit of Carlton Mellick and a little bit of Kevin Donahue, a little bit of D. Harlan Wilson. But when I first conceived Kitten, which is basically the part that came to be the first half of that book, I really hadn't read very much Bizarro at all, but stuff I had been writing, I thought of myself as a fantasy writer, but what I was writing was more along the lines of, like, Twilight Zone or this kind of weird stuff that I was having a very hard time finding markets for. Didn't get very many stories accepted, and I didn't really know why at the time, because it just seemed natural to me to take the usual tropes of science fiction and fantasy and even, like, light horror, and then take them and twist them and turn them on their heads and do weird things with them, because it just seems interesting to me, and that's the sort of stuff that I like to read. It wasn't until I found Zorro and found out about the new Zorro author series that I really had somewhere that I thought, like, they might accept my writing, they might accept what I'm doing. It might be exactly what I need to find. So, yes, I guess around the time that I got Kitten published is around the time that I officially decided that Bizarro was what I was doing. And ever since then, I've been reading more and more of what the various Bizarro presses and imprints are doing, and reading a lot more of the other authors, and I'm very into what's going on with
it. How do you give a synopsis of Kitten? I'd like to hear it in your own words. I mean, I know what I got out of it, but why don't you try?
Wow. Yeah, I'm still not very good with the synopsis of Kitten. Part of that is that it began as a short story that kept expanding and kept expanding, and then I wrote, like, a kind of a companion short story, which becomes the second half of Kitten, and then I kind of wrote an ending that ties both of those together, but really, there's two different stories in Kitten. And so it's always been hard for me to try to sum up in some brief little log line what's going on in that story. And that's why maybe it makes it a little harder for me to sell it to people than some other books. But, all right, my best attempt to give a synopsis. Oh, Jesus. You would have thought I might have thought this would be a question that would be coming in this interview, but I didn't even...
Start with a mond, maybe.
What's that?
Start with a mond.
Okay. All right. A mond is a mother of a young boy who has a kitten. Kitten is not really a kitten, but kitten represents a problem to her, and she does everything she can to get this kitten out of her life, which sends the kitten on a journey of self-discovery and exploration, in which it decides that its purpose in life is to go back and destroy a mond. In the midst of this, there's this young boy who's kind of caught up in between these two active characters, and so he's kind of pulled in various directions between the actions of his mother and the action of his kitten, and all he wants is just to have a pet and be happy and be loved by his mother. So at the end of the story, trying to see how that all plays out for him. But yeah, those are the three characters that come into play.
And yeah, there is a very sharp divide at the beginning of the second half, where the focus shifts to the point of view of the kitten, who gets a new name, or I guess an actual name, Willoughby, thanks to Tamani, Tawani or Tamani. Yeah, the guy with the Scottish guy with the fish hands, the fish for hands.
Is he Scottish? You're not the only person that's made that comment, but I don't remember him being Scottish.
I think it was Michael Allen Rose that's put that image.
Yeah, he gives the name to Kitten.
You know, I think there's sometimes a bit of confusion when I've discussed Kitten with other readers about who the main character or protagonist of this book really is, you know. Like Michael Allen Rose in his Bizarro Central review said, a mond, the first time I read it, I thought it was Willoughby, you know, because he kind of closes things out, you know, and learns how to will, you know, he brings about the ending by willing it to happen, so to speak, right? Well, who do you think the main character is?
I would say say there's actually two, because like I said, kitten is two different stories that are tied together but with a common ending. So in the first half, I would say Amand is the protagonist. In the second half, Willoughby becomes the protagonist, and their interests are sort of at odds. So the ending attempts to, you know, give some resolution to that. Yeah, it was an unconventional approach because I never conceived of it as a novel in and of itself. It was a short story, and then another short story tacked on. I think it worked. I mean, I hope it worked, but I guess a lot of people would view that as a cheat. You know, I didn't really write the novel. I just put two short stories together, but I think it worked.
I think it worked, too, and I can almost detect a Monty Python-esque influence in your work. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think before I got into Bizarro, I guess one of the things that kind of pushed me in a weirder direction was the influence of Monty Python and that kind of surreal humor with just, you know, non sequitur and these kind of deeper, weird connections that are being made in the comedy that can take things branching out in many different directions so that within the course of the story, there's many different little tangents that are explored that all kind of relate in an indirect way to what's going on in the story. And that's definitely Monty Python. I think Douglas Adams is another one that probably influenced me in that direction.
Now, the image of the kitten that's not a kitten in the beginning, puking up stamps from all over the world, What does that imagery mean to you? Did it mean anything to you when you were writing it? Is there any sort of hidden meaning that we're meant to discover from that? Does it mean anything to you?
I think the image came to me sort of more than a conscious choice. It was that's what I saw. That's what I saw happening. It was stamps. And then kind of worked that more into some of the things that I did with the story, in the second half of the story, the world that the kitten goes to is full of all kinds of collectible objects that are more or less useless junk. But that's what the stamps are, I guess. It's something that perceived to have some kind of a value, even though they're ultimately useless. So in his vomiting this up, he's a completely useless character. If you want to look for any sensible meaning to that.
You know, there should always be one scene that leaves you breathless, I think, in a Bizarro book, where it truly shows that you're dealing with like almost an alien intelligence. And, you know, for me, that one scene with Kitten was in the second half near the end, where Willoughby and his friend with the fish hands are watching. In the kingdom, they're watching, I guess, this play, and they realize that the puppet on stage, the marionette or whatever, is actually a dead kid. And that ties back into the spectral gate in the beginning. And the collector who keeps dead kids in his trunk, it's all very overwhelmingly weird. And, you know, that image really stuck with me the most, you know, where they realize that's a dead kid on puppet strings. I mean, what an image, you know?
Several other people commented that was, one of their favorite parts of the book, and I think it's definitely one of the darker moments of the book, which is probably more comic than it is horror, but that's one of the more horrific moments, I guess. That was something that, actually I had originally intended to use in an entirely different story, but, I felt like at that point it really worked well for what I was doing with the second half of Kitten, so I ended up splicing it in there, and it went off pretty great, so I'm glad you liked it.
And from what I understand, there was quite a good reception, a strong reception for Kitten, that it was one of the better-selling titles. You know, you don't have to name a figure or anything, or a number, but from what I understand, it was one of the better sellers from last year's class. So were you met with a lot of respect at BizarroCon, your second BizarroCon, this past year?
I tell you the truth, I mean, I felt like since it was the second year I'd been there, that a lot of the people, it's just naturally, the more you see people, the more you get to know them, and the kind of mutual friendships and respect flow out of that. I don't think how many books somebody sells really plays that much of a role in how much you like to see somebody at a convention. Like, I mean, honestly, that's not how I formed any of my friendships with the other authors. If I do like something somebody writes, then I will try to get to know them and see, you know, what we have in common. And if I don't like what they write, if they're a nice person, then I'll still be their friend anyway. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it did impact it somewhat, but I didn't notice that.
I think, you know, I think I worded that one a little poorly. sorry about that. What I mean is, I guess, were you happy with the reception to Kitten, maybe, is what I should say?
Well, every year when they do Bizarro Author Series, they give a target figure that everybody's aiming to hit. And my book didn't hit that. So I guess in that aspect, yeah, I feel like I should have done more to promote it. And thing is, only just now am I really realizing the mistakes that I made in terms of the way I'm trying to promote myself and networking and all. But I feel like I did with it about as much as I could with the level of knowledge that I had at the time. So, I think that in the future, when I publish more books, and go back and look and see that I have this earlier book called Kitten, and they will find out about it then, and it will probably be a fairly decent seller for the rest of my career. But, I don't know.
Okay, let's talk about a little more in depth about your time as a New Bizarro author last year. You say that you may have made some mistakes along the way, but I mean, you know, that's common. Are there any secrets of the trade that you could pass on to this class or future aspiring authors who might want to get into this series?
Well, I think the thing that I found that kind of worked for me was I was doing on my blog, Strange Edge, I was doing feature flash fiction. And in that way, I got to connect with a lot of other authors that were kind of just starting out, or also some that were already established. And just by reaching out to people and asking to feature their work, does a lot to help build good relationships with those people who in the future will think of you as, you know, somebody who was not just an asshole trying to worm their way in to get what I want out of the situation. You know, I am legitimately concerned about helping out other authors that I like and feel like they need better exposure. I do what I can to help them. And in return, I hope in the future it pays off by they remember me when they have opportunities to help me out as well. But I guess summing that up, what I mean to say is make friends with a lot of people who are kind of at the same level as you or even slightly below you, people that have never been published yet, people that are working to get published. And those kind of friendships last a lot longer than, you know, hoping that you can get the attention of somebody who's a published author who has a million things that they're busy with and already has a million commitments, trying to hope they will do something to help you with your career. Probably better to make a lot of friends with people on your own level. That's my advice.
Yeah, I think I understand. In other words, even though you are selling a product, don't make it so obvious. You know, don't be a salesman, right? Be a human being, right? I mean, you know, get involved in the scene actively. Don't just try to peddle your own wares, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, be legitimately interested in what the other people are doing, too, because, you know, if you're not coming across as a real human being, then, you know, the chances that they're really going to care what you're doing to promote yourself are very slim. So, you know, it's the don't be an asshole rule, and I think that applies to just about every field, is, you know, be good to people, treat them well, and, that pays off.
Very good. Now, you've got a lot on your plate otherwise too. Along with working on your follow up to Kitten, a second novella, you also have a two flash fiction websites. Well, I mean, first Bizarro Central, where you host Flash Fiction Friday with up and coming, you know, weird authors, bizarre authors, and also The Strange Edge. Do you get fulfillment out of both of those?
Oh yes, absolutely. Being able to do the Flash Fiction Friday on Bizarro Central is a great honor. When they approached me to ask me to do it, I was completely out of the blue. I had no idea that it was going to be happening. And it's a great way to help people who are trying to get their foot in the door, Bizarro scene. It's something that I think has a good impact without taking up a whole lot of my time. I mean, it's one day a week, it's not that much editing needs to be done with that. And then over at The Strange Edge, which is my own personal blog where I can do whatever I want, that's where I can go crazy with doing things. Like currently what I have is a little program where giving out randomly generated titles that are produced with these online generators that automatically come up with crazy titles. So I pick the titles out of that are good. I give them to other people. They write it, send it in, and I publish it. I can publish that as many times a week as I want, or I can publish it never, you know. So it's completely up to me, and I can come up with whatever crazy ideas I want to do with that. Actually, crazy ideas. Over on Bizarro Central, trying to do some crazy ideas of my own over there, which was, for Halloween this year, I did a special thing where I brought together five authors to do kind of related stories, tell the tale of a serial killer or a slasher that I dubbed Creepy Crawly. And so I had M.P. Johnson, Robert Devereaux, Shane McKenzie, Gabino Iglesias, and Alan M. Clark. Had all five of those guys come together to work on a project that I had conceived of to try to generate some more traffic to the site. And I don't know if that worked or not, but I think we all had a lot of fun doing it, and I'll probably try to do something else like that in the future, where it's a little bit of a bigger idea than just a one-off piece of flash fiction on Friday. There's a continuing story, or, you know, related interweaving stories by various authors to get some interest generated.
Yeah, I remember the Creepy Crawly. Gabino's piece in particular surprised me, with the guy driving in his sleep for 2 hours. I mean, you know, that's a road that's definitely fraught with risks. What have you ever helped in the construction or choreography of one of Vince Kramer's action figure orgies? I've got to know.
I've witnessed him in the process of doing it, and he is so legitimately enthusiastic about it. I mean, he's like laughing his ass off the entire time, and this is what he really loves to do. I took him some action figures when I went out this past November and visited him. I brought him some. They were all like rescue workers, like EMTs and firefighters and a couple cops, and he was having a ball with them because they had these little lights, like big flashlights for like rescue. But he was having it as though those were the video cameras, and the action figures themselves were actually filming the porn as he was creating these orgy scenes that he was then documenting. So, pretty wild. He's a good guy.
He's a good guy, huh? You, Kevin, Donnie, and Vince are like the three amigos every year at when BizarroCon comes around, right?
Well, yeah, I got to spend a whole lot of time with both of them this year, and I'm sure we'll do many, many things together in the future. They're both super easy to get along with, and we love each other. Great.
Well, now let's talk about your next novel or novella that you're working on. I'm assuming that it's for Eraserhead Press, but I mean, what is it about? I know a little bit about it, I think, but why don't you paint a bigger picture of it?
Oh, Yeah, well, I kind of just finished my first draft of a story called The Long Night of the Korean War. The Long Night of the Eternal Korean War, which is loosely a MASH parody that gets very much into some serious postmodern issues, and as well as like issues about God and art and mankind's existence and his own storylines and things like that. I mean, I guess it's a lot of themes that are kind of touched on in Kitten, but this one's probably a little more philosophical in Kitten.
And so, do you have a projected release date? Would you like to get it out before the end of the year, or is that looking less likely now?
Oh, I'd like to get it out before the end of the year, but at this point, it's completely up in the air what's going to end up happening with it, so I can't really give any projections on that yet. But it will be eventually released by somebody in some point, so, you know.
Tell me about your process. Do you, some people draft as they go along, and others redraft and redraft, each time getting a little closer to carving out the whole picture. Which do you prefer, and are there any quirks in your process?
I work very very much fluidly and unplanned as much as possible. That doesn't work for every kind of project, and in fact, the next major book that I'm going to work on, I will actually have to do a lot more plotting beforehand. But generally, like with Kitten, for instance, I literally just started that out with the idea of a woman on pills. Her kid is annoying her, and he has a kitten. It's not a kitten. And from there, the entire rest of the story just came out of my fingertips, you know, writing basically sequentially the entire thing and going back and tidying it up afterward. So I guess my process is much more let the chips fall where they may, have your only basic target goals that I want to get to. Maybe like, you know, this, I know how the first act ties into the second act and how the third act ties into the ending, but everything in between just kind of happens. And so, I mean, I write so fluidly with things that I have a hard time going back in and taking anything out, because basically I have to rewrite that whole section. It all just is interconnected so much in how I tell it that I really hate to edit. That's my point. I don't like editing things.
It gets painful, doesn't it?
What?
It gets painful, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It can, you know.
Now, you have several pieces slated for anthologies, not just the balancing act for our own Vertigo Schisms anthology, which was the first piece that I accepted for that anthology, and I'm delighted to have it, but also you had a piece in Bizarro, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I did. That's a piece called Pitfalls of Modern Gardening, and that one might be the craziest thing that I've ever written. That really has, it's like earlier you were referencing kind of the Monty Python aspect. This one is probably the most Monty Python of anything that I've ever written. It's just completely absurd, completely zany.
And what else? Isn't there also Axes of Evil, the metal-themed horror anthology?
Yeah, I did have a story accepted for that one. That was a really good story, and I really hope everything goes well with that. So.
Any others?
nothing firm at this point. I have been working with a few other authors to try to get together an anthology. I don't really know what I'm going to do with it yet as far as who I can convince to press it, or if I'm going to go ahead and start Strange Edge Press to get this thing out there. But it was along the lines of the random titles thing. I brought together several other authors that are all writing stories that all have these same randomly generated titles. And the idea is to kind of create sort of an by 10, 12 different authors or however many end up participating in this thing. But that should be pretty good because I have a lot of good guys that are attached to it right now that, assuming everything goes well, should be a really, really cool thing.
Strange Edge Press, I think that would be amazing.
Yeah, it will be. The only problem is that I think the name Strange Edge Press is a little too close to Strange House Books, maybe, so I might have to come up with something else, but I would like to have Strange Edge somewhere in the title, or somewhere in the name, rather.
Well, now, what kind of short fiction do you look for in submissions for both Flash Fiction Friday and The Strange Edge?
Well, I mean, for Flash Fiction Friday, it has to be Bizarro. So there's a slight more constraint than what I do with The Strange Edge, which could be experimental, literary, anything else that necessarily piques my interest. But when I choose for Flash Fiction Friday, I want it to be for a Bizarro audience because it's Bizarro Central. So that's a little more constrained. I tend to judge what I'm going to publish on there by a slightly different standard than my own personal stuff that I like for Strange Edge, which Strange Edge stuff be generally more to the kind of absurdist or surreal side. I like a lot of prose poetry and stuff like that, so that's what I tend to gravitate more toward for that. But, I mean, I've published all kinds of stuff on there by authors that I've solicited stuff from. Everybody from M.D. Johnson to John Edward Lawson. And Jeremy Robert Johnson even let me reprint one of his shorts from his We Live Inside You collection. So, all kinds of stuff. But I like stuff that's smart in general. Little more, I guess, party. That would be my personal taste, I guess.
Very good. Not to get off on a political tangent, but I feel like I just have to bring it up as an aside or something. You are a proud libertarian, correct?
Yeah, I'm a libertarian. I don't know how proud I am of it. I think the label gets misinterpreted by a lot of people, but yes, I'm definitely leaning that way.
Certainly nothing to be ashamed of, I believe Dr. Carol Quigley in the 60s said that he had examined papers proving that both the left and right paradigms, that is, Democrats and Republicans, were both the one essential system. And that they were both rigged, the two-party system itself, the false left-right paradigm, was rigged, and like I said, not to get off on a tangent, but I think that we need someone, a personality that is strong enough to run on that ticket to add legitimacy to a party that is just begging for some legitimacy, because aren't we tired of left and right? Am I correct?
Yeah. Well, you're trying to convince me to run? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, it's a possibility, You don't have any skeletons in your closet, do you? You take your skeletons out of the closet, don't you?
Yeah.
Just something to think on, man.
Yeah, but no, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I definitely have big problems with the kind of the sports team mentality that both the left and right have as far as how they approach the issues. Being on Facebook and people posting political memes with these very simplistic and often completely inaccurate statements about the different issues. It is slightly infuriating to me because I'm a very logical person. I'm very much of an individualist, so these things to me, they seem like, it's just such obvious bandwagon idea that it's like, we're Republicans, so we think this, or we're Democrats, so we think this. And whenever their guy does something that's bad, they never seem to pay attention, but whenever it's the other team, they can't wait to point it out, you know. Stuff like that drives me nuts.
Thank you, yes. I've seen you on there, man. You're almost like an artist when it comes to poking holes in arguments. You know, you really like to deflate those balloons, and you're exceptionally good at that. Have you ever been on the debate team?
No, I guess the only formal kind of training I ever had in this would have been like my introductory logic course when we covered logical fallacies and things like that. And I think it's very helpful to understand how to make a proper cogent argument in order to, you know, recognize when somebody else is deliberately using something to trick you into believing their whatever they're trying to get you to believe. And, I mean, that happens all the time in politics. And it's just also saddening because this is something that is never really taught in public schools, that critical thinking and analyzing, you know, what it is your leaders are trying to get you to do, because it doesn't benefit that system. So the idea is, you know, have your people as docile and easy to your rhetoric to as possible, and then, you know, they never even realize how much bullshit they're being sold. But that's what it is.
And have you used this this applied logic in your writing at all as of yet?
What's that?
Have you used what you've learned from this applied logic, these applied logic courses, in your own writing? Have you used them to focus arguments between characters?
I think in general, Lewis Carroll is another hero of mine in terms of Alice in Wonderland stuff is some of my favorite writing of all time, and that was definitely also a very big influence on Kitten. But he was also a logician, and I think that people have this misunderstanding that if you have a very logical mind, that you can't be whimsical or absurd. But I think it's kind of the opposite. I think since I am so logical in my day-to-day life, that kind of absurd stuff to me is hilarious. You know, I love deliberately undermining logic in the world, in the way the characters are interacting with their world, or in the way the characters think. It's such that to me it's hilarious. You know, it brings me a lot of enjoyment. But in my day-to-day life, I am not a very absurd person. I'm a pretty serious, logical guy.
Very interesting. Well, Gary, we're about the 36 minute mark. Is there any other parcel? Are there any other parcels of wisdom that you'd like to throw out there before we wrap this up?
Parcels of wisdom. Well, be excellent to one another.
Very good. And thank you for coming on. That last musical number was Black Coral Dream, which came from a sample courtesy of Cody Goodfellow, our guest from last weekend, with his electronica project, which I guess is defunct now, but still some amazing sounds on there, real celestial and also subversive. And the title of that project of Cody's is Worker and Parasite, which kind of goes hand in hand nicely with my opening monologue, I guess, huh? We're coming to a close on the reading of submissions for the Vertigo Schisms anthology, and I have one new acceptance, and I'm not sure if there will be more. We're getting close to the end, the real nitty-gritty, but that one new acceptance I wanted to announce, The Revenge of Charles J. Hogg by Rich Bottles Jr., which you will probably know that name from several Strange House books, anthologies that are out and available as well. So, yeah, quite a diverse lineup of personalities and authors and styles in this, our second Surreal Grotesque anthology, Vertigo Schisms. And I'll be talking more about that over the next few weeks and months as we get closer to the full development and realizing the broader picture of it and making it come to life. Also, I am downright jubilant to announce that our guest for next weekend is Jeff Burke to talk about his sequel to Shatner Quest. And we'll talk about William Shatner, why he chose to base a series of Bizarro books around William Shatner. If William Shatner knows about it, what does he know? When does he know it? We'll talk about his Choose Your Own Adventure book, Supergiant Monster Time, and Cripple Wolf, about a Vietnam vet who's a werewolf, and also the musical tastes of people around the Eraserhead Press offices, which may surprise you. And so Jeff Burke next weekend, cannot wait. That may be one of our biggest to date, or at least since Garrett Cook or Kevin Donnie. And you know, as Gary said a few minutes ago, be excellent to each other. Music this weekend was brought to you by Austrian Death Machine, Uncle Acid, Worker and Parasite, and Brad Sucks. Now go out and feel something.